Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're really focused on the Constitution. It's Content Day, which means that we're going to be, and I say we, that means Paul Venable is back. And by the way, welcome back, Paul.
Well, thanks, GR. Rough week last week. I'm glad to be up and moving around again.
It's always good to be vertical.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. You know, and I've never really equated, you know, the concept of being horizontal, but I guess as you get older, the more weary you become of becoming horizontal.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. It turned out that I was, you know, pretty much flat on my back for a few days, and then something happened. Friday, I had a kitchen sink drain problem, and I literally had to get out of bed and do something about it. And that may have been good for me. Okay, my water's running; it's draining just fine, and I start getting better right away. So that's good.
That is good. That is good. Okay, so having health and good drainage in the kitchen is important. So
that's right.
In your absence, I kind of flew through a few sections that I thought maybe you would want to, you know, that would pique your interest, because folks, we're using the color-coded Constitution, which just means that it helps us highlight, you know, the infractions, the violations. We dream of just infractions.
Right.
The blatant violation and tyranny that we're living under. And so is there any go-backs regarding 4, 5, 6, or 7 before we jump into 8?
Well, real quick, there are some things that are just relevant to today. And forgive me, I probably didn't hear the show, so I want to touch on maybe briefly 4, you know, the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives. This is something that was a problem, I think, in the 2020 election, in which Bob Schultz, in his petition to Congress that they got before January 6th, he pointed out that this may have been violated. And so that's one of those things that's an issue today.
Well, so, yeah, so actually it was, so just so you know, and, you know, a lot of people don't realize that there's two parts in the Constitution, there's two articles that cover elections. And the reason why this is here is because this covers the elections for representatives and senators. If you notice, it does not mention the electors. See, most people don't realize that elector is a federal representative. It's the representative of the people for a very specific responsibility within the process of our federal government. And that process is the choosing of our president. See, most people just, you know, they vote for candidates because they've bought into the democracy that, oh, we elect the president directly. And then the party, and this is how the party has completely absconded, taken full control over our presidential elections. And this is why we've had nothing but globalists in the process or in the fray driving the agenda since the late 1800s.
You know, that's a point, because Section 4 here does not refer to electors. So, you know, there are electors must be dormant. You know, so representatives, we have elections every 2 years because mm-hmm. representatives are every
right.
2 years.
And senators. And senators. Right. Remember that
right.
one-third
right.
of the House one-third. Is up. Yeah, there you go. Right.
One-third of the Senate is up. But then that reminds me, if it's not a presidential election year, yeah, we're not voting for electors.
That's correct.
And so in this particular case, they're not mentioned. Thanks for pointing that out.
That's right.
That makes a lot of sense.
But the responsibility, so, again, the responsibility lies upon the state legislatures. Now, okay. It does say the Congress may at any time, by law, make or alter such regulations. However, if you notice that it goes to the state first, that would only be, and the bottom line, this has been pretty much, I'll just say, understood or accepted that the practice would be that that Congress would only step in if the states were unable to do it, such as we were in the throes of a war and the state legislatures couldn't be formed to do their job, you know. Okay. But to be clear, what ended up happening, and it didn't happen because Trump was president. Okay, so all right, here's one in the win column because of Trump. Because Trump was president, he didn't usurp or tell Congress to go ahead because there were 30 some states that had no representation in the state houses, and there was a need to change the manner of how we choose electors. And he may have actually, by looking at this, thought that they were the same. Because most people don't realize that the electors is actually separate. And there, when we get to Article 2, you'll notice that it does not have a clause allowing Congress to actually usurp that authority. So in other words, in presidential elections, if Congress actually tried to intervene and choose the manner, place, and times, and that's not in the proper times, place, and manner in the proper order, but if Congress tried to do that, they would actually be violating the Constitution. They could only do that in regards to the senators and representatives. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Because there's a hard delineation. There's a demarcation line that basically says when it comes to the choosing of the president, the Congress shall have no influence over the election process. Only the state legislators. That's why it is strictly in Article 2, and it strictly gives that power to the state legislators, not the states,
right.
Not the states, the state mm-hmm. legislators, the representatives in the state. So anyway, hopefully that helps clarify
it does
that.
Help.
Okay, good. Anything okay. else? Five, six, or seven now?
Well, so five, you know, again, each state shall be the judge of elections, returns, and qualifications for its own members. What occurs to me is, again, January 6th, now they're looking at the electors. Now, does this – the electors also isn't mentioned here.
That is not.
Okay, so
you're
this
right.
is correct. So this is just for its own members.
Correct.
So let's say that Congress is in session – representatives, senators are being seated, but maybe someone has a question about, you know, return of qualification of a member, its own member, and so the Congress, one or the other of those bodies could challenge the seating of a member, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, that's a good question, because I don't think I brought this up. You know, your mind is on all these other things, and you forget about all these little ancillary things. And so forgive me, folks, that this is why it's helpful to have somebody else here to, you know, kind of hold me back. So, you know, like it's, I guess most guys, we just want to get the job. We want to get this house built, so get the people right. in there, finish the product so that it can be purchased. Anyway, in 1811, a representative in Virginia was improperly or voter fraud was involved and or election fraud. I forget which, or maybe both. But a person had just been seated by the House of Representatives. This is in 1811. And a gentleman who was actually... He basically asserted that he was the one that was properly elected. And he went and he used a First Amendment petition to the House of Representatives to step in and say, hey, this guy did not win the election. This guy you just seated, he was the incumbent and I beat him. And so, you know, they all kind of looked around and go, huh, And so what did Congress do, or what did the House of Representatives do? They immediately they went out to verify the real outcome in that congressional district to determine whether that person was actually properly elected or not. And they overturned the seating of the representative and seated the challenger who actually did win.
But now this is important. He used the First Amendment petition and Congress responded.
Yes. So let's be clear here, folks. If you want precedence, if the court needs precedence, this is all you have to do. And as a matter of fact, every representative out there that lost their election, you know, like Bob Dornan. Remember Bob Dornan? Anybody remember Bob Dornan?
The name's familiar, but I don't.
So Bob Dornan, and if you look it up, you Google Bob Dornan House of Representatives election. I believe it was in the 80s, and this was when, right after Jimmy Carter started allowing illegal aliens to be counted in the consensus, or in the census, I should say, to apportion more people to California. And so after the 1980 census, they did redistricting. And so Bob Dornan was in office, and I think he was in office for a few years. But at that same point in time, there'd been increases in illegals invading, you know, America, and these illegals were able to get registered for voting and so forth. And Bob Dornan called foul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, if you look at what Bob Dornan did, Bob Dornan made the challenges where? I believe he made the challenges in the state. And there were players already, the deep state in California already existed because the DMV and all of them already, you know, started embracing these policies of giving, you know, handing out the votes to anybody and everybody. Because, I mean, on the heels of this was Clinton's motor voter law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was just, you know, that was less than a decade later when that happened. But if you look it up, Bob Dornan was, I think it was probably the late 80s maybe, but he was, you know, challenging the veracity of the election, and he didn't go to Congress. But the real problem was, it didn't, you know, as far as I'm concerned, does he really have to petition Congress? Because what does it say right here? Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't each, you know, house, the House of Representatives and the Senate, you know, have a committee that really takes that serious and says, hey, if there's any challenges, we're not seating you until we've done a thorough investigation. Because right. Obviously we can't trust the shenanigans at the state. There's
sure.
Always, you know, surprise, you probably never heard me say this, but it's always been the states that have been the bad players.
Okay. So he didn't petition Congress.
I don't believe he did.
Okay.
So all right. In my opinion, I think he really failed to pull the appropriate attention, because Congress has a constitutional duty. It's mm-hmm. clear right there. They have a requirement of verifying the qualifications of those people coming in that they're going to seat into the chamber. So they also have, you know, the control over their rules and punishments and so forth. And as far as I'm concerned, I think I may have mentioned this, but I believe that the states, now that the states have a dynamic interaction, now that we can actually dynamically interact with the House of Representatives and the Senate, because Madison and the framers couldn't even fathom this, that the state could literally launch, or I should say pounce, that's a better word, pounce upon the Congress in minutes from them mm-hmm. doing something that, you know, goes, you know, viral in the news. The Congress just did this. Boom. The state houses could easily and quickly respond.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, I believe that they need to have a clause in here that gives the states power to intervene in saying, we believe that that is so repugnant that your conduct or that person's conduct, like John McCain, he should have been removed from the Senate for many of the things he did. And the same thing with many of the Democrats. Mm-hmm. Many of the Democrats, especially today, when we see Democrats actually violating their oath by violating the Constitution, we... And I'm expecting, because we kind of had an ancillary email regarding Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but we need to actually insert that here because, and if you notice, I actually have that little line modified by Amendment 14 or the 14th Amendment, Section 3.
That was going to be my next question.
So that's my modification, but technically it never was modified. And that's my point. Technically, the 14th Amendment actually did modify this part. However, mm-hmm. the Congress just, you know, they didn't implement it or they didn't take. So the radical Republicans implemented it. But when, as soon as the corrupt Democrats and Republicans got into office, they completely obviated it. They completely removed its, you know, concepts and paradigms out of the chambers, and they were not going to hold themselves accountable in accordance to, you know, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So this is why I really believe that the states need to add a clause in here where the states, where, you know, it just requires 51% of the states, mm-hmm. just a basic majority of the states to demand that, you know, a full investigation and punishment be delivered and allow the states to dictate what that would be.
Wow.
In other words, the states say we want a full removal in accordance with the law, because the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is the law.
Mm-hmm.
And the states have every right to demand the rule of law. This is a Correct. Republican form of government, not a dictatorship.
Correct. So this part here, where, so one of the things that we haven't wrapped our head around is we've got Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but it doesn't appear on its face right away that there is a mechanism to enforce it. But what you're saying is right here, Section 5 is a mechanism to enforce it, but Congress is ignoring it.
Oh, absolutely, especially for the members of Congress. There, it also needs to be injected in Article 3.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's in Article 3?
That's the judiciary.
Yeah, the judiciary. And it basically says the judiciaries can be removed for bad behavior. Well, no. We want to inject Section 3. We need to inject it. We should demand injecting Section 3. If they fail to support the Constitution in their rulings, and they come up with, you know, who was it? Ginsburg? Or there was a judge on the court that deliberately brought in international law.
Ginsburg. It was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Yeah. She actually said, I often look to international law.
Right.
She said that.
She should have been removed on the spot. She should have been removed on the spot for failing to support the Constitution
mm-hmm.
and injecting law that had no place in America.
Right.
Okay. So.
Okay.
This all helps, you know, I think anybody that really starts looking at how Section 3 should be in play, you know, and mm-hmm. not in play the way the Democrats want to claim to use it because they're going against the government, because that's not the measure of Section 3. Section 3 is the measure of going against the Constitution. And mm-hmm. so, folks, there's a movement with some constitutional scholars trying to prove that they can hold it against Trump. And so we'll get into that when we get to the 14th Amendment, which is, you know, a couple of weeks maybe. But we'll dive into that in detail.
All right.
Anything else? Section 6, compensation, blah, blah, blah.
Not that stands out right away.
Okay.
You know,
Section 7. Bills with revenue shall originate.
Ooh, Section 7, bills with revenue. Let me tell you.
Okay.
So, you know, first sentence in the Constitution, all, that word is A-L-L, all legislative powers herein granted are vested in a Congress of the United States.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the president, not in the courts. And so let me give you an example of what happens. Everyone's freaking out about Biden going over, and they're claiming that, he has ceded our sovereignty to the UN. Okay, first of all, he doesn't have the authority to do that.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
He doesn't have – he has no authority to legislate by executive order.
That is correct.
Which many presidents think they do. And, you know, I mean, he had this executive order about the CDBC. He's got the executive order about any number of things. And I actually believe that this either Build Back Better or green energy thing is something that he brought with him. And what does he do? Does he have any authority to impose law on the Congress? Now, he can probably suggest this is what I'd like to see, but he certainly has no business writing it.
That is
and
correct.
I'm just wondering, right?
Right. You're absolutely right. Right. Yep.
And I'm just wondering if that's what we've been getting. And get this, the Congress allows it to happen.
Yes, right? Correct. So what do you do then? When Congress doesn't guard the separations of powers, then what?
Well, then the states have to recall them, or at least bring it to their attention. And who does that in the states? Well, the people, you know, the people have to stand up and petition their states and petition their counties that, hey, Congress is off the rails. And they are. Right? Did I miss something?
No. So Congress actually does have a capital R requirement in taking a stand and defending the Constitution. Right? Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Sure.
So, folks, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is in play so much, so often that, you know, one's head would just spin because we'd take the next step and come right back around to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. They have even the judiciary has the capital R requirement of stepping in and engaging when one branch violates the separations of power.
Now, the judiciary is typically passive, so I'm curious to know how the judiciary would do that.
Well, so
you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely. So the judiciary is absolutely passive when it comes to cases.
Okay.
When it comes to, you know, seeking justice, but the judiciary can actually step up. They can't create a law. They can't do anything, but they can actually come out and speak. I mean, they're not muted, right? I mean, we see the I don't know who the woman is that we call Lady Justice, but, you know, she's blind, right? But she's not deaf, nor she's not mute. And she has the ability to actually, and any justice has the ability to come out and be clear regarding the Constitution that no one is allowed to put their thumb on the side of the scale that favors them.
Mm-hmm.
And so
right.
When anybody assumes powers that are not delegated, that are actually delegated to another branch, then they've put their thumb on the scale of power.
Okay.
Right.
And so, well, it says something to where we are, and it's either ignorance or deliberate, but if Congress should be jealously guarding its legislative authority.
Absolutely.
Jealously.
Absolutely.
Okay? And they're not.
And say the state should need to do the same.
Right.
So, but it all comes back to us because I think when the framers, because they were such honorable men, they just went in and people watched and they were in awe with, you know, for the most part, the good things that they did and, you know, how they kind of executed. And there were those, you know, side-oblique movements, and we just went into a break here, Paul. So hold on, we'll be right back. So they obviously played these side-oblique movements that went, you know, into different directions that the Constitution didn't allow, like Hamilton, who was notorious for that. But we'll bring this back up when we come back around so we can get Paul's take on this. And then we'll actually probably, we're about ready to get into Section 8, folks. So hang on, we'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we were going into break, we were kind of diving into the separations, the court having a passive role, but it didn't mean that they were muted. It didn't mean that they were dumb. You know, right. In other words, dumb that they couldn't speak. They couldn't right. actually take a stand and say, hold on here. As a matter of fact, when it comes to the Constitution, when we realize that our public servants do not understand the Constitution and they're actually operating outside those boundaries, we have a right to not only petition them, but we have a right to instruct them. There is no reason why anybody, because we've seen it in the Senate. We've seen it in the House of Representatives, where we've had courageous constitutional representatives in either house. And we've actually seen it, you know, at the, if you want to call it the bully pulpit from the president, because there have been many times when Jefferson, Madison, and presidents actually spoke out about the Constitution and how important it was. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court. And as a matter of fact, Taney made the, you know, we all know that Taney went up to Lincoln and said, look, you don't have the authority to do that. And Lincoln snapped back and said, let me see you enforce that. And so it doesn't mean that, you know, because the separations of power, you can't say something. And the justices right. should actually be out and they should be leading on the Constitution. Now, when I say the Constitution, not the annotated Constitution. As a matter of fact, the justices ought to actually point to that annotated Constitution and say that is an abhorrent, you know, abomination.
Well, they're not going to do that, Chair, and you know why? Because they're depending on the annotated Constitution. It's case law.
Yeah, yeah.
It encourages. It elevates their importance, the importance of the judicial system over the Constitution.
Better yet, it is their creation. It is almost like killing their own baby.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
There's this pride in authorship. There's this pride in position for the court today. Because John Jay, who was appointed to the Supreme Court and then asked to take a leave of absence, and was mm-hmm. replaced during that point in time so that he could go work on the treaty for the Mississippi River.
Okay.
And he came back as an abject failure. And so, I mean, most people know that little story, but what they don't know is the little story beyond that. After his, you know, his healing of the wounds and, you know, his self-pity and, oh, you know,
right.
After, you know, everybody made a fool of him for, you know, doing such a cruddy job, they came back around, and I think it was Adams. I think John Adams went to John Jay and said, hey, you know, I'd like to seat you back on the Supreme Court. And John Jay basically told him, no, that's okay. The Supreme Court is really a do-nothing job. There's nothing there, you know, that gives you any, you know, reason to live. Because it's not like you're leading. You're just sitting there viewing, and you're just, you know, who wants to be the guard at the gate? because that was really the intent of the Supreme Court, was to guard the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
And he just didn't want to do it. And so instead, John Marshall was given complete latitude. And John Marshall, as a good underling of Alexander Hamilton, did everything he needed to do to basically create case law and precedents for later to be used. Because at that point in time, case law and precedents was not even allowed. Mm-hmm. It was then adopted when they claimed common law practices over the Constitution. And then later on in the 1900s, they basically said, we're not recognizing common law, but they still maintain case law and precedents.
Wait a minute. They help me understand this.
The whole premise of case law. So just so you understand, the whole premise of case law and precedents common law. In other words, civil law is law that can only be changed and controlled by the government. And so civil law gives government full control to make whatever changes they want to make. Common law allows for common, cases and precedents to actually be used to, to protect and or to inflict a realignment of the law to, get into the commonality or those common paradigms. And so, yes, they didn't necessarily declare it, but they injected it under the principles of common law.
So, but it sounds like what you're saying is they used common law to break common law, because in the 1930s, the Supreme Court declared it was just going to stop.
That is correct.
Doing it.
Correct. Well, they're no longer recognizing cases under common law. But that means that they still allowed. See, the Constitution gave no allowance at all, none at all, to the Supreme Court or to the federal court system to be able to create or use common law. Each case was to be judged based on the merits of the Constitution, period. It's like contract law.
Okay.
Now, contract law, there's only one thing that I know of, and there's probably a lawyer out there that probably could inject something else. But there's one thing that became a common law practice in contract law. It was called collateral estoppel. In other words, you have a case where somebody comes along and they basically go after their, like if you have a subcontractor to do some work for you, and you go after them, and you go after them over one little issue, and then you, get your case won. And then you go after them over another little issue and get your case won. And in other words, what you do is you keep on dragging them into court to financially ruin them with their legal costs.
Right.
And so collateral estoppel is it's a known practice to say, look, you can't keep dragging this business, this entity back into court. You have one shot at seeking your full justice, and that's it.
Okay.
And so if they try to bring you back and it's something that existed that you didn't bring forward in the case before, collateral estoppel would kick in and say, look, you had your shot. You can't keep on dragging this entity back into court. So collateral estoppel was kind of created as a common law practice to protect, the less, financially stable, the subcontractor, the little underling that could be crushed by, the big mighty government or the, this big, entity that had lots of money to basically bleed you legally. So but that's my point. I mean, contract law doesn't have, actually I shouldn't say it doesn't, because contract law is actually the fundamentals of common law, right? Because if it has been stipulated, then it is, it's legally appended, or it is legally amended to the Constitution if it's been stipulated.
Okay.
And so those are practices of common law of how contract law had been formed, and it has not changed since we've really matured it in the 1900s.
So just so there are a lot of us out here who believe there's a place for the common law. And so I just want to make sure that we understand, maybe the audience understands, because that the common law is subject to the Constitution. So we brought the common law from England, and the Constitution, I think there's one place, maybe two places in the Constitution, and that's in the Bill of Rights, that refers to the common law.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so it's understood, even though it's not specified in the Constitution. So why is it so clearly understood and thought for? I mean, we have people advocating for the common law, and probably should, as opposed to civil law. But I'm nowhere do I recall that we talked about this before, where the states are supposed to choose their type of law, right?
Yep.
And
yep, that's correct.
Where the states choose common law, where was that? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. So that was okay.
Okay. And there was one other thing about common law. I'm sorry, I'm throwing all this. And that is that common law we inherited probably had some elements that wouldn't fit in the Constitution. For example, I've heard that in the common law, you burn a heretic at the stake. Right?
Yeah. That's especially okay. French. Yes.
Okay. And so that's obviously not something that we would have adopted under the Constitution. So, I'm sure there are people out there, especially people who are listening, who understand that we seem to be living under a two-tiered legal system.
Okay, yes.
Right. And so how do we maybe this is another discussion, GR, but at some point.
Let's look at the Constitution itself. The Constitution created a subcontractor, created this entity called the federal government, and it gave the federal government very specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and property. That's it. These are the few things that the federal government can possess. So it didn't necessarily inject common law as the law, because as anybody will tell you, when you look at common law, it is basically based on the Bible. And so that was the one thing that separated England from the rest of the states of Europe, because as many of the states started migrating away from what we call common law, and because common law was actually based on the Catholic Church and how they perverted it into, because they incorporated common law and civil law, which was a Roman Empire type of law. And so, but the Catholic Church also created a theocracy, and then they basically moved everything to the state, to where the Bible couldn't use the Bible to question the church. This is why the whole point of Martin Luther breaking away, and how they broke away from the civil law this hybrid civil law that the Catholic Church has started inflicting upon Europe. And so as many of the other states started breaking away, well, the one thing that England did was England always had the Bible going all the way back to the Magna Carta. Even before Martin Luther, they maintained the Bible as the common law. Well, but here's the thing. They didn't necessarily have the Bible in their hands. When did the Bible really start getting printed where it became common again? 1500s. The Magna Carta actually moved and created a separation from the church itself, and created a what we'll call a social compact between the people and their ruler.
Okay.
And so they kind of move forward, because, when you really look at the biblical law, that it goes all the way back to Moses, well, there were some gaps, there were some jumps and so forth that actually, kind of happened. that it wasn't a continuous evolution from Adam to today. Does that make sense?
Okay.
In other words, there were literally breaks in time and breaks in implementation to where, because when the Catholic Church started ruling, that was under the auspices of Rome.
Okay.
And so, I mean, Christ obviously didn't create a government, did he?
No.
No. As a matter of fact, he basically created a church and considered the separation at that point in time between the church and government. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, long story short, you know, as Europe and Western societies tried to get, you know, more righteous in their society, it was England that was really the outlier that it started incorporating these old, you know, common law, Mosaic law, the law of judges and so forth into their, you know, into their society. And okay. So when we came here, there was a vast difference in the colonists and so forth, and how they implemented common law, and how all of the other states of Europe by that point in time had migrated more towards civil law.
Hmm. Okay.
And so if you kind of look at how that all happened, it all happened, I think, because England wanted to be different.
Okay.
And England thought that, you know, sticking to, you know, this common law and the Bible was a better way. Well, one of the things I've learned is that even though England may have been different and it had this righteous, a more righteous legal system than any other system in Europe, the government and the crowns of the monarchies of Britain became some of the darkest and most evil. And I say this because in my article, I'm kind of pointing out how Britain had deliberately manipulated the slaves, not just in America, but how they manipulated the importation of slaves and created black-only slaves in America, which made, you know, Thomas Jefferson call them out, call King George and the British crowns, I should say, out for these atrocities against humanity.
Okay.
And he even points out how Britain, you know, they actually supported the arming of slaves in an uprising just to manipulate and play with us, to keep us divided or keep us, you know, on our heels so that we couldn't really get organized against them. Not only did they do that, but they also had these relationships with the Indians. And so, because why did they have these relationships in the West with the Indians in the Ohio Valley and so forth? Because it was a part of creating alliances against the French. Well, when they had these lingering alliances with the Indians, well, and these Eastern states, the colonies, actually started separating. Well, England had their fingers over there. They already had these alliances. So they created this hostility. They supported, Indian hostilities and so forth against us. I mean, they were always playing these manipulative games.
Right. Catch something before it gets away from me.
Okay.
In that you referred to something you said, black only slavery.
Uh huh.
You know, because that suggests that there was more to slavery than captured Africans.
Oh, absolutely. The term slave actually was a derivative of the Slavs. So, in other words, the usage of the word slave was actually what was the common slave of the time when that word became, you know, just common, that we had to have slaves because, you know, they just, I don't know what they called them back in ancient Egypt and what have you. I think we adapted that word to whatever the language they had, because by that time we all understood what a slave was, and a slave was a derivative of the Slavs. They were the preferred slaves of the world. I mean, Thomas Sowell, in his book Red, Black Rednecks and White Liberals, he actually, you know, dissects this whole thing, that the term is actually regarded. So most people think that slave means black. No, slave was a term to the Slavs, because if there was a Slav, you know, you just saw, oh, there's a Slav. Well, that's a slave.
So this had some Russian footings, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Peoples, absolutely. Yeah. Right? So in Russia, at the time, America had, at the Civil War, I think the numbers vary somewhere between 5 million and 9 million. Mm-hmm. As many slaves in America. In Russia, there were 22 million slaves at the same time, serfs. And the difference was, a serf is a slave to the land. In other words, you know, whoever had the money bought that land, and those people came with it to work that land. In other words, they couldn't be, you know, taken with you. They were a part of the resources of the package. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So you bought the land, you bought the people that were on the land.
Yeah, they were, let's just consider them machines that come with the land to, you know, regardless. They till the land, they do all of this stuff. And they, you know, are taken care of by the landowner.
Okay.
Right. And so, which is one of the reasons why the paradigm of communism really came to Marx very easily.
Because
Russia was steeped in slavery and serfdom.
Okay.
And so, he was trying to create a solution to basically, you know, free the people, you know, or I should say, free a single class of people and enslave all people equally.
Hmm.
Right?
That is
ironic.
Brilliantly sinister.
Yeah.
Is the word I would use.
It's okay. Ironic. Or he was a paradox. He was a direct conflict with his own mind. I mean, almost everything he did in the Communist Manifesto was a paradox, by just stating that all labor was equal. In other words, the brain surgeon is equal to a janitor, or equal to, you know, a street sweeper, or a tax collector, or, you know, a bodybuilder, an athlete. Come on. The value of, you know, what a brain surgeon, or these people that are capable of doing great things because they're highly educated, compared to just a basic labor, they're all equal.
Right.
And anyway, so we can see how social justice kind of runs
amok.
Oh, well, right. it's just taken this whole equality, equity crap and, yeah, absolutely gone crazy.
Wow.
So anyway, we were going to get into Section 8, but we had all of these little sidebars, which is okay.
I wanted to kind of catch up, okay, and on any comments I may have had, and thank you for allowing me to do that.
No problem.
Okay,
so Section 8, I'll let you read the preamble, because that's the first couple lines.
Okay.
Before we get into the actual delegated powers.
Okay. So, let's see. Section 8. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States.
Okay, now I already kind of covered this, but this is a preamble. In other words, this is a basic assertion as to what the government is going to do with the powers that are going to be following. In other words, this is not establishing general welfare and defense powers. They are listed. The following powers are basically being provided for the intent of creating common defense and general welfare for all of the states or for the Union. The one part in here that I have to point out again is the very last part. All duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Now, the 16th Amendment jumped in and changed the way Congress shall have the power to lay collect taxes by basically going to the states. And so if you look at Article 1, and I think it's the apportionment portion in Section 2, probably, I'm guessing, but I think that's where it's at. You'll find that that line, there's a portion of that that gets changed because it talks about apportionment for taxes and representation.
Right.
So the 16th Amendment breaks away with the attachment of apportionment, and it breaks away with this attachment of laying taxes to the states. And it changed. The only thing the 16th Amendment does is it says we will now collect taxes directly on incomes and not be tied to apportionment and, you know, actually, you know, go directly to the people and or any entity that has income, businesses, corporations, or what have you. And this is the government's insidious way of getting into the knickers of businesses and so forth, and then starting to create these regulations. Oh, well, now we can tax you. Now we can create these other laws, when they couldn't. I mean, The only legitimate thing was they could tax them, not regulate them on how or what they did. The claim of the we'll get into the Commerce Clause later. But the fact is that the taxes had to be uniform. If they're going to have a business tax, then they have to have a business tax for, you know, everybody equally.
Right.
So when
they're blatantly violating that.
Absolutely. And it's the same thing with the personal income tax, because personal income tax is progressive. The more money you make, the more money they take. And that violates the uniformity clause. The only type of tax, they can tax income, but it has to be a flat rate. It has to be.
Right. Has to be uniform.
Has to be uniform. Correct.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
So how much more do we want to cover really quick?
Well, we've got the next one is to borrow money on credit of the United States, and we can just kind of stop here. Because bottom line, to borrow money on the credit of the United States is to actually say that they need to spend money. Mm-hmm. Right? The federal government needs to spend money, but what can they spend money on?
Only what they are allowed to do.
Okay.
And I'd say in this article, Article 1, Section 8.
Yes. What are they can spend money on territories. Can they spend money on acquiring land? Yeah, okay. So they can grow the United States because that's in the interest of the United States. It's a strategic purpose because they're bringing in more states to create more revenue. Mm-hmm. It serves the union to grow the union. And so they cannot spend a penny on nothing. They have no enumerated power, role, responsibility, what have you. And so they can borrow money, but they can't borrow money to spend on anything that they want. They have to have a very constitutional purpose for the spending or the expenditure of that money. Thank you so much, Paul, for joining us. Folks, we're going to pick up right where we left off tomorrow. And so join us as we continue to go through the Constitution, because I'm hoping that all of these conversations that we have and these deep dives that we go into help you understand the Constitution and get you on the path of becoming a constitutional warrior. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.